If you wish to make an apple pie from scratch, you must first invent the universe.
If you're scientifically literate, the world looks very different to you. It's not just a lot of mysterious things happening. There's a lot we understand out there. And that understanding empowers you.
If you base medicine on science, you cure people. If you base the design of planes on science, they fly. If you base the design of rockets on science, they reach the moon. It works, bitches.
Alrighty, so we got a couple things. Apparently, and this is something that, you know, those of us of a larger girth, larger stature, are sometimes concerned with. And that's those midnight snacks, those little calories that you might be consuming a little close to bedtime. There's new evidence that says it doesn't matter when you eat things.
I'd like to see a lot more evidence about that.
Yeah. So apparently, you know, apparently a lot of the things that we've been brought up learning are just myths, like the eating a hearty breakfast, you know, first thing in the morning kind of thing. Don't really need to do that. It was important perhaps when you were about to then go burn all of those calories when you're out on the farm.
Or hunter-gatherer.
If you're a cubicle worker, that's probably not that important. You know, just going along with that. So there are so many myths and strangely specific rules about when to eat to lose weight, but alone they do nothing to help. Eat a hearty breakfast and light all day, eat small meals every few hours. Rules around when you eat are less important than you think, and even when they do help, they're not for the reasons you think. Sorry, there's nothing special about eating breakfast. It's not the most important meal of the day, at least not for everyone. For years, people, especially cereal marketing companies, touted the benefits of breakfast because it supposedly kept you from overeating, jump-started your metabolism, or insert any other reason to manage weight and obesity. But there's a wrinkle. A majority of breakfast studies are biased. A study from American Journal of Clinical Nutrition found that most research on skipping breakfast and weight gain was conducted with the explicit intent to force that correlation. Similarly, the argument that school-aged children who skip breakfast are more likely to be overweight seems compelling, but the focus is more on the school breakfast program and whether a child eats enough at home, rather than breakfast itself being the game changer. So what's more, some of these breakfast studies are funded by the food industry, including cereal companies like Kellogg's and General Mills, who have vested interest. The author of the study says, personally, I flip between eating breakfast and skipping it alone. Eating breakfast or skipping it matters less than what you eat, how much of it you eat, and what other lifestyle choices you are having. Bottom line, people eat breakfast for a variety of reasons, but eating or skipping breakfast itself isn't going to help you suddenly drop a pant size, which is, it's very true. It's all about, it's all about the individual experience. Mama Van says, in the chat room that breakfast just jumpstarts my appetite, which makes her hungrier perhaps through the day. And I will say that, yeah, I have seen the same thing. If I eat a certain amount, which seems to be variable from one day to the next, I might be able to, you know, eat a good breakfast and then not eat until 3 p.m. or something like that. You know, a really long stretch. But otherwise, I have the munchies all day. So it also depends on where I am and what I'm doing, whether or not that's going to work for me. So, basically,
my breakfast is caffeine-based.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Well, my breakfast is always caffeine-based because I'm actually a caffeine-based life form. Yeah, you know, few people actually know that. Apparently, you don't need to eat immediately after a workout either.
Yeah, which that's a big thing because back in the day, I was kind of part of the, not quite the hardcore bodybuilding crowd, but definitely in the, you know, having the protein shakes, having all the stuff, having the pre-workout. I loved being in the gym. It was my zen place, especially when I was not actually working, and I would work out 3 hours a day for 6 days a week. And that was in one shot from about 5 a.m. to 8 a.m. every day.
Wow.
And yeah, I would take pre-workout. I'd hit the gym. I would just go. And as soon as I was done, it was take some of that post-workout protein and everything else. I'm interested in what it says here, that basically, there is no real post-workout anabolic window, which is the thing that I have heard about, where you have to take some amount of protein, you know, fairly decent amount of protein inside this certain window, which is about an hour to 2 hours, if that much, sometimes less. Mm-hmm. In order to have all those gains that you have, you know, so your muscle can build everything up. What this is actually showing, and I'm loving this, is it doesn't matter. The only time it's going to matter how quickly after your workout you eat or have a lot of protein and carbohydrates mm-hmm. is if you're going to have another intense workout later that day. Right. If you're not, it doesn't matter. Your gains aren't going to be spontaneously wasted. Your muscles aren't going to go, damn, I worked out so much. I don't have protein. Oh, well, nothing really happened. That's not how the body works.
No.
They're going to sit there and do what they can with what they've got. And then as soon as you kick in stuff, they'll start using that. Yeah. It doesn't matter. Just give it to us when you've got it.
Yeah. You know? No, it doesn't really matter for people that are doing such weight gain kind of things. All you're doing is just absorbing more calories. Just that's the time that you're going to feel like you could absorb another 2,000 calories in a protein shake. You know, so it could work for you. You might just feel better that way.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it is often they are loaded with sugar as well to make them taste better. So it also will, you know, kick a few neurons in place and say, ooh, that's a reward. I got a sweet. Yum.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the brain hacking is a thing, folks.
It's really cool, too. If you can totally figure it out and do it, it's really neat.
Yeah, it's
again,
great.
The brain can do some interesting stuff.
Yeah. So in this article, just to keep with it here, say it with me, eating many small meals does not boost your metabolism. In fact, for some people, the more they eat, the hungrier they feel, and they may end up eating more calories, just as I said, I might through that out the day, than they would with fewer calories with fewer larger meals. On the opposite end, having more meals to look forward to throughout the day can benefit some people psychologically. Again, brain hacking, especially when they find dieting to be difficult, and help them avoid binging after a long, hangry day at the office. Plus, there are health reasons to both eat and avoid eating frequently, like maintaining blood sugar. So, a study in the British Journal of Nutrition notes that your body will process all those calories just the same, whether they came in one or three big packages or seven smaller ones. In essence, frequent meals are simply a key strategy in helping you maintain your appetite and mindful consumption. So if more meals works for you, then you do it. You do you. That's the thing. And Mama Van, caffeine is not just a food group, as you claim. It is a lifestyle choice.
Yes. I'm sorry. I do believe the proper term for us, Andy, is caffeine Americans.
Caffeinated Americans.
Caffeinated Americans, yes.
Caffeinated Americans, certainly. But, you know, just to jump from that, because that's just the best thing ever.
So the true fat kid one?
No. Something that I didn't put in the show notes just yet, but I will now. So it'll be number 3 for you. There you go. Okay, so now you can look at it, too.
Oh, yes.
Apparently, scientists seek UN approval to create Asgardia, Earth's first space nation. Are you ready to be a citizen of Asgardia?
Just so long as the citizens of Asgardia are known as a seer? Yes.
In brief, Asgardia's founders plan to send up a satellite in 2017 and eventually build a nation where people can live, work, and follow their own rules and regulations. While far from a reality, Asgardia does bring up questions about the legalities and logistics of space colonization.
Because here's the key thing for everybody out there. Space, as agreed upon by every single world government that has able to get into space, is 100% free of any form of actual national boundaries. Nobody owns it.
That's true. There are treaties involved with keeping it that way as well. However, if you start having citizenship status in that no man's land,
that's where it starts getting
funky. Yeah. So ambitious plans to create the world's first nation in space were unveiled this week in the hopes of ushering in a new era of space age. Igor Ashburly, head of the Aerospace National Research International Research Center, the AIRC in Vienna, and chairman of UNESCO's Science and Space Committee, heads the initiative in close collaboration with a group of scientists, engineers, entrepreneurs, and legal experts.
Asgardia, I will jump up there in a heartbeat. As I will happily go up there in a heartbeat if they open it.
Yeah. Asgardia, named after a city in Norse mythology, will essentially function as its own sovereign country where citizens can eventually live, work, and follow their own rules and regulations. That is, if everything goes according to plan. Ashburly hopes to secure UN recognition for Asgardia, a nation of scientific exploration free of geographical restrictions, but no word yet on whether that will actually happen.
Well, geopolitical restrictions.
Right, right. Besides joining the UN, the founder's ultimate goal is to build a high-tech shield in space that will protect their fellow humans on Earth from cosmic, man-made, and natural threats, such as space debris, coronal mass ejections, and asteroid collisions. The first step, however, is to send up its own satellite in 2017 and begin efforts to open up access to space. Project is still in the early stages, but the team behind it is hoping that the publicity it gathers now will attract talent willing to work on making Asgardia a reality. The talent can be anyone, as Asgardia has opened citizenship for everyone on Earth. But what does being part of this nation mean? Basically, Asgardians will remain physically on Earth, but will become a citizen of this new space nation, which the founders hope one day will join the United Nations. Eventually, those citizens could then travel to the space nation itself. We have not seen any nation attempt this before, so this will be a first. Ramjaku, an Asgardia founding member, told Business Insider, quote, we'll start small and eventually people will be going there and working and having their own rules and regulations. This facility will become an independent nation.
Throwing on the thing underneath that, here is the actual link to the Asgardia website where you can sign up for citizenship.
So you can find those in our show notes for O'Reilly Radio episode 128. Sounds good. And, you know, I keep calling all the listeners of the show citizens of Netlandia. Well, perhaps we should just be citizens of Asgardia, too.
Well, the funny thing is, I almost say they've got a somewhat of a case, not necessarily for yet becoming part of the UN, but for creating their own nation. Mm-hmm. Because there have been examples throughout history, especially throughout the 20th century and the beginning of the 21st, mm-hmm. of micronations being created.
Yeah.
You know, some of them with some problems and some legal issues like Sealand. But Sealand's also been around for a while now. You know, but there's other examples of them out there. So
Sealand has been around for a while, but I think it's defunct now.
No, it's still there.
Is anybody still living there?
Yeah.
I thought that they had to evacuate for some reason. I thought they were all gone. But, who knows? We'll have to look. But, yeah, it's sketchy territory. And part of being a nation is being able to defend your nation versus mm-hmm. other nations that wish to, you know, come and take your stuff.
Which is really easy if you're in space, I mean, let's be honest here.
There is a barrier to entry. There is, for now. But, you know, who knows? They get a space elevator going up there. It, you know, keeping the riffraff out might be a little difficult. Let's see. So other things that we can talk about under science.
The fun world of comas?
The fun and fancy-free world of comas. This is neat. I found this out on futurism.com. The world's first ultrasound, ultrasound was used to jumpstart a patient's brain out of a coma.
Which is like, wait, what?
In brief, a 25-year-old man has made incredible progress after doctors jump-started his brain out of a coma using ultrasound. The team asserts that further study is needed to determine how effective this ultrasound technique really is, but they have high hopes.
Because for all those people out there, when it comes to comas, do not think, for the love of the gods, do not think about your standard procedural drama show or everything else where, oh, they're in a coma and they wake up. No, doctors literally will tell you, for non-medically induced comas, they go, we don't know when they're going to wake up. We don't know if they're going to wake up because they might never. And it's actually very rare for somebody to wake up out of a coma.
Yeah. The treatment, called low-intensity focused ultrasound pulsation, was led by Martin Montani, Martin Monti, M-O-N-T-I. I'll get it eventually, a UCLA associate professor of psychology and neurosurgery. As its name suggests, the treatment made use of sonic stimulation to stir up the neurons in the thalamus, the brain's focal center for processing information. This was done because, as previous assertions likely made clear, doctors hoped that this would help jumpstart his brain back to functionality. And notably, according to the UCLA newsroom release, the patient has regained full consciousness and full language comprehension after, here's the kicker, 3 days.
Which is really, really impressive.
That's super cool. Heck, he even fist bumped one of the doctors to say goodbye. So language centers sometimes can lag behind actual wakefulness when people are coming out of comas. So the fist bump, that was the communication he could manage, you know, when you think about it. The changes were remarkable, says Martin Monti, UCLA associate professor, blah, blah, blah. I already said what he was. I don't know why they did too. It's almost as if we were jump-starting the neurons back into function. So the reliability of the treatment requires further study. It's possible that we're just very lucky and happen to have stimulated the patient just as he was spontaneously recovering. So at least they're having
they're being
real
very
good,
smart about
solid
it.
Solid case of realism.
Doing actual science for a single data point does not mean make the entire study.
Right. But it's really interesting that you could do such a thing at all.
Well, in a way, it's almost, I mean, I would say it's almost like using a pacemaker or other things to start a heart. It's the idea of the, wait, focus here and generate a response. And that, since the brain is an electrochemical engine, you get a response. It starts firing out from that part, and everything else, like an engine turning over, might just spontaneously go, oh, we're working again. Oh, we have to do stuff now.
Yeah. Now, if you remember Star Trek, whenever they would put like little pads, you know, in sick bay, they'd put little pads on the side of the head, and they do brain scans and possibly shock people back into wakefulness. They're actually thinking that this treatment could eventually be used for low cost portable devices to help wake patients completely from their comas. That's cool stuff.
That is very cool. 100% behind this.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Why aren't we funding this? Oh, wait, we are.
I think we are funding this, or at least somebody is.
So now we need him to become a vigilante, breaking into hospitals and waking up coma patients to prove his point.
What if they don't want to be woke up?
Wake up. Oh, God, no. Put me back out.
Yeah, it's like, I was having the best dream for the last 20 years. Yeah. Who knows?
Really? I wake up to this crap hole? Damn
Hard
it.
Hard to say. So,
yep.
I found an article on four different websites, all talking about the same thing. I haven't put it in there yet. So this is a surprise for you.
All right.
So we were talking about it earlier with if we go back, it is not that one.
Is that a menu? Oh, okay.
It kind of is a menu. Yes, it's my ballot. Constitutional Amendment Number 2 for Florida, the use of marijuana for debilitating medical conditions. Now, this is Mary Jane's cousin, hemp. Hemp is, for anybody that's done any research on the product, a remarkable fiber. It's basically the plant stalk that is related to marijuana. It doesn't have the THC.
It's related species.
So it's close. But basically, when they banned marijuana, they also banned hemp production because they're so close.
Because hempcrete is so useful.
Yes. Well, some people would actually go ahead and argue that they banned marijuana because of hemp. Because of how useful it was as a
director of the cotton industry.
As an industry disruptor. Yeah. Well, not only cotton, but also the paper mills and construction equipment. You know, all sorts of things it's useful for. Well, apparently, it just got more interesting. Hemp waste fibers form basis of supercapacitor more conductive than graphene. Silkworms spin super silk after eating carbon nanotubes and graphene. And hemp fibers better than graphene. That was in BBC News. So I've got one on Digital Trends, one in Scientific American, one in BBC News, and another one out in Futurism. Graphene-fed silkworms produce super strong silk that conducts electricity.
Yeah, I read that one, which is cool. Where the hell did the hemp come into this?
Well, apparently, that's, I guess they're adding in the graphene.
Fed both?
I think that's their diet, is like a graphene hemp. Let's see. So let me get that article out to you real fast here.
Number 4.
Yes, number 4. This is the BBC article. Because the BBC is good that way. Okay. So, the waste fiber from hemp crops can be transformed into high-performance energy storage devices, scientists say. They cooked cannabis bark into carbon nanosheets and built supercapacitors on par with or better than graphene, the industry gold standard. Electric cars and power tools could harness this hemp technology, say U.S. researchers. They presented their work at the American Chemical Society meeting in San Francisco. Quote, people ask me, why hemp? I say, why not? Said Dr. David Milton of Clarkson University, New York, who described his device in the Journal of ACS Nano. I guess that'd be the American Chemical Society Nano. We're making graphene-like materials for a thousandth of the price, and we're doing it with waste. Okay.
Oh, look, recycling. It's amazing.
All those things are good. The hemp we use is perfectly legal to grow. It has no THC in it at all. So there's no overlap with any recreational activities. let's see. So in countries including China, Canada, and UK, hemp can be grown industrially for clothing and building materials. But the leftover bast fiber, the inner bark, typically ends up in landfills. Mitlin's team took these fibers from and recycled them into supercapacitors, which is really amazing. Conventional batteries store large reservoirs of energy and drip feed it slowly, whereas supercapacitors can rapidly discharge their entire load. They can also rapidly charge. That's one of the best things about them. So a combination of having supercapacitors and like large volume lithium ion or even lead batteries, combining the two, then you'd have a electric car that could go plug in, charge up insanely fast, and then during the process of driving, it's actually still charging the batteries from the supercapacitors that it just filled. Yeah, that's the kind of technology hybridization that would be really advantageous. So, stronger than diamond, more conductive than copper, and more flexible than rubber, the miracle material has the target of was the target of a £50 million investment by UK Chancellor George Osborne. But while the carbon monolayer in is the state-of-the-art material for commercial supercapacitors, it is prohibitively expensive to produce. So the big thing here is that this is cheap.
Mm-hmm.
Cheap, 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 cheap. They've tried peat moss, eggs. They even managed to turn banana peels into batteries.
I remember hearing that.
Pretty slick. You can do really interesting things with bio-waste. We've pretty much figured out the secret sauce to it, said Dr. Midland. The trick is to tailor the right plant fiber to the right electrical device, according to their organic structure. If you look to hemp fiber, its structure is the opposite of what they're doing with the bananas. It makes sheets with high surface area, and that's very conducive to supercapacitors. The first step, he explains, is to cook it almost like a pressure cooker. It's called hydrothermal synthesis. Once you dissolve the lignin and the semicellulose, it leaves the carbon nanosheets, a pseudo-graphene structure. By fabricating these sheets into electrodes and adding an ionic liquid as the electrolyte, the team made supercapacitors, which operate at a broad range of temperature and high energy density. Direct comparisons with rival devices are complicated by the variety of measures for performance, but Midland's peer-reviewed journal paper ranks the device on par with or better than commercial graphene-based devices. They work down to 0C and display some of the best power-energy combinations reported in the literature for any carbon. For example, at very high power density of 20 kilowatts per kilogram, kilowatt per kilo, and temperatures of 20, 60, and 100 degrees Celsius, the energy densities are 19, 34, and 40 watt-hours per kilo, respectively. That is a lot of energy density. I mean,
that's impressive.
I mean, people that don't deal with batteries very often are, it's like, okay, those are numbers. But really, that's a lot of density. I mean, with, think about the recent rash of Samsung Galaxy Note 7s that have been exploding in people's pockets. This density is much higher than the lithium ion that is simply in those batteries. And there's a lot of energy in those batteries, as you know. So, just as a little comparison, fully assembled, their energy density is 12 kilowatt hours per kilo, which can be achieved at a charge time of less than 6 seconds. Less than and 6 seconds.
I'm also thinking, like, okay, standard weight of batteries, I'm just going off, say, 50 kilos, so 110 pounds, which is then 600 kilowatts. Using the numbers they've got there, fully assembled.
That's a car. Yeah.
That's essentially what you've got. It probably would weigh less than the total battery capacity that is currently in the Priuses, and yet probably has more power.
Yeah.
I need these. Hey, Elon Musk.
All need these. We all need these. This is gonna
actually with that big, again, operating in lower temperature places like, you know, Northwest and such in Canada can be problematic, but say for places down here, imagine, okay, say you've got a 500 pound battery system for your house.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
And you've got solar panels. Oh look, they're charged and you're good to go.
Mm-hmm.
You lose power. Okay, I've got power for a week.
Yeah. That's basically it. And as long as they don't break down and they maintain that charge, like they don't have just a dissipation rate, which does not seem to be something that's mentioned in this article, at least.
Also, just to throw numbers out there, because I like doing random, small, quick math, a 500-pound battery using the numbers they've got there, which would be 226 kilograms, would be 2.7 megawatts.
Megawatts.
2,700 and change kilowatts.
That's nice. That's
so
nice.
Hi. I could rent my house for maybe a month. Power needed.
Maybe depends on what you do.
Yeah,
depends on what you do. Having established a proof of principle, his startup company, Alta Supercaps, is hoping to begin small-scale manufacturing. This would be for energy storage. $500 to $1,000 a ton. A ton.
Yeah.
Wow.
Also, just to throw numbers out there as I was going on things, the average annual electricity consumption for a U.S. residential utility in 2014 was 10,932 kilowatt hours.
Okay.
Yeah.
I'm not average.
No, but still, it's the idea of
You
could build a decent sized battery that wouldn't actually be that big, or battery, array. Mm-hmm. And hi, you're good.
Yes. So this has a lot of really interesting aspects to it. Not only just the, hey, look, we get to do this with waste material, but what if we don't want to just do it with waste material? We need a higher supply of the waste material, which is no longer waste. Then we are going to be encouraging farmers to grow hemp.
Mm-hmm.
Which it can even grow in Alberta.
That's true.
So
and thank you, Mama Van, for that. The PSA, yes, don't put your tongue on a charged supercapacitor.
No,
really, trust me, really you'll only do it once.
Yeah. And now, a fun thing to do, with the kiddies, is to take one of those disposable 35 millimeter cameras that you can get, and after you've taken the roll and everything, and you've wound that all that up, just tear it apart. Just rip that thing to bits, and you'll end up with a battery, and you'll end up with the flash capacitor. Charge that up, and instead of discharging it into the strobe, just bridge the contacts with a nice insulated screwdriver, and you'll leave some decent marks, and also create a nice loud pop. Kids love it. Kids love it.
At home science experiments.
Exactly. Now, that's just a regular capacitor. And whenever you click that button and you hear that whine, that's it charging up. This would be the equivalent of charging up car batteries, full car batteries from zero to full.
In six seconds. You know what? That would solve the whole major problem we deal with looking at the idea of, like, the Teslas and everything else. Yeah. Like, okay, I'm traveling. I want to take my Tesla on a road trip from, say, Florida to Seattle.
Yeah.
I mean, don't want to have to park after 300 miles and I now have to wait 6 or 12 hours or however long for the whole thing. It's you pull into the station, you put your card in to pay for whatever power you're going to do. Plug it in. 6 seconds later, ding, done. It will be faster than filling up your car nowadays.
Exactly. That's the thing.
And then you're good for the 300 miles, go, and ding.
Mm-hmm. Now, you'd have to have some serious discharge into the capacitor, but that's just infrastructure.
So yeah.
It can be done. It can be done. The hardest part about about working with large battery arrays is, especially when you're dealing with lithium ion, with lithium technology, maybe not lithium ion, maybe another type, lithium polymer or something, you have to maintain a constant charge over all of the cells, and each of the cells has to be manually controlled by the circuitry so that they do not overcharge and so that they can balance out the entire pack, essentially. Mm. And that's actually what happened with the Samsung Note 7.
Overcharge?
Well, so it weakened some of the cells, which is why sometimes they would burst into flames in your pocket while they were not charging. They were discharging, putting thermal stress on the pack into a weakened section of the battery.
Mm.
there it goes. So, not so good. And also, you don't want the same thing to happen to much higher density batteries, which would be things like your Tesla, your Nissan Leaf, your Chevy Bolt.
You don't need those Ford spontaneously combust
hybrids, Toyota, and everybody else. You know, we've got a mandate to do hybrids, so there's batteries and big battery packs in all of these cars now. So, yeah, it needs to be done properly. This is fantastic as far as the technology, and I've wanted a supercapacitor in all of my electronics for a long time. It's dangerous, and if it's not handled properly, it is super dangerous. So, think like Pinto kind of dangerous.
Just driving down the road and suddenly, boom!
Yeah, it's like, oh, look,
You're now on fire.
Yeah, because the thing is, with oil and, you know, gas, it has a really high energy density.
Mm-hmm.
And what we're doing is we're just using a little bit of it at a time to make small explosions. You know, when you really think about what an internal combustion engine does, it's kind of difficult. And if all of that goes at once, it's a huge explosion. Same thing with the batteries. We're using a little bit at a time, but if they all go at once, that's a problem. You know, same deal. So it's not like they're any less dangerous than we already have, but the technology needs to grow with it. And we're really there. We just need to... This is just exciting. It's so exciting. Big future stuff. Now, speaking of internal combustion engines, Germany, I don't have the link, but it was in the news over the last cycle when we weren't here. They decided to ban internal combustion engines within the next 30 years.
Interesting.
So they're forcing the automotive industry of both Germany and essentially the entire EU at that point.
Yeah.
To get rid of internal combustion engines entirely. Not even hybrids. They want them gone. So
be interesting to see how they can pull this off. I mean,
it's just regulation. They're forcing it. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I'm just looking at the cost and
it would be for consumers. So things that require more, like trucks,
military vehicles. Lorries.
Military vehicles are always exempted.
Yeah.
You know, things that require more than just consumer vehicles. So a basic car, a basic light truck, even, you know. Of course, they've got, you know, super compact cars and things like that. Ah, thank you, Mama Van. She found the Ars Technica. Apparently, she had already heard about this. Whoa, okay. Thank you, Microsoft Edge, for immediately going weird on me. Yes, by 2030. So actually less time than that. I will put this link in the show notes. Thank you very much, Mama Van. And there we go. Okay. So the tide turning for the internal combustion engine? In Germany, things are starting to look that way. The Bundesrat, the federal council of all 16 German states, voted to ban gasoline and diesel-powered vehicles by 2030. So diesel as well.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know actually how extensive this goes. If you follow that to Spiegel Online, of course it takes you to the German version. So good luck. If you speak German, then, you know, hey, there you go.
Part of what is part of this is a backlash against VW.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
Especially with the diesel. Cause well, thanks to watching years and years of Top Gear, most of the standard usage and big vehicles that are in Europe are all diesel based. They were high efficiency diesel engines. They weren't standard gas.
Well, you got more MPGs out of them.
Mm-hmm. Again, they decided to take the... We decided to go, oh my god, emissions, we have to get the particles down, Mm-hmm. And all of Europe went, no, we'll just make the engines a lot more efficient, so they're releasing less over time. Because you can go longer.
You get a little bit of both. A little bit of both. Let's see. So it's a strong statement in a nation where the auto industry is one of the largest sectors of the economy. Germany produces more automobiles than any other country in Europe and is the third largest in the world. The resolution passed by the Budapest calls on the European Commission, the executive arm of the European Union, to, quote, evaluate the recent attacks and contribution practices of member states on their effectiveness in promoting zero-emission mobility, end quote, which many are taking to mean an end to the lower levels of tax currently levied on diesel fuel across Europe. Europe did have that big bet on diesel, which we were talking about there. And, of course, companies were cheating on their tests. Because they could, so they did. The resolution, which passed with support from both sides of the German political spectrum, that's interesting, is non-binding. So this isn't a sure thing, but it's evidence of a trend that has been gathering steam in Europe with increasing tough emissions laws and moves by individual cities to restrict the use of fossil-fueled powered vehicles. Huh. Interesting. So there is a promoted comment. If you read the actual revolution, it's a bit more complex. I'll summarize since it's in German. It's a reply to this EU document from the summer, and it basically states that the Bundesrat's idea of and suggestion about the subject matter, edit as Nanos points out in a comment further down, this document is merely a letter that's letter with suggestions for the EU Commission and doesn't ban anything, since that'd be beyond the power of the Bundesrat. There's six bullets here. So since it's impossible to make industry and agriculture emission free by 2050, the goal should be to get zero emission mobility by 2050 to be achieved in a way that doesn't endanger EU prosperity. EU should be decarbonized, carbon neutral, I guess, by 2050.
Just remove all carbon, all people, vehicles, buildings, all carbon gone.
Yeah, just get rid of the carbon-based life forms. That should do everything that you need. This should be connected to noise reduction efforts as well. A mix of tax strategies and financial incentives should be used to make all newly registered cars zero emission by 2030. So that's probably what's going to happen. I'm really thinking this is going to hit the consumer market more than it will the business market. It's important to look at emissions from railroads and ships as well. There should be subsidies for public transportation and bike and car sharing. Yeah. Of course, this is also going to, with the rash of Uber and Lyft and self-driving vehicles.
Mm-hmm.
And the ability of the newer Teslas to possibly do a ride sharing concierge kind of service. I think by 2030 we're going to see a very different kind of road nearly everywhere.
But solar roadways.
But it's, I don't know, we're never going to see solar roads, man. That's just, it's too out there. Maybe
I guess I'll have the love of my heart.
Maybe in the Arcologies.
In Asgardia.
Yes, the Arcologies in Asgardia, they will certainly have solar roads. Maybe rainbow roads, too. Or at least bridges. Rainbow bridges.
That's the name of the space elevator?
Yeah, the Rainbow Bridge.
The Bifrost?
Yes. So, this could be very interesting. You know, if we just combine all the different trends that we see, with higher capacity batteries and, you know, self-driving vehicles, more intelligence on the road there. Yeah, they're going to do it. It's just an eventuality at this point.
Yeah, it's that slow crawl to progress. We're going to see it in less something happens, we blow ourselves back a few decades or a few hundred years.
Yeah.
You know, we're going to see this progress regardless, because technology always likes to move forward.
It does.
It's just when. You know, we're saying, okay, probably by 2030, we're going to see some changes.
Yeah. Apparently, the cost of solar energy itself, this is, this was another that... that I didn't drop in, but I will drop in just as a bullet point. The cost of solar power has fallen 25% in the last 5 months.
Yeah. And Florida passed the Amendment 4. So I'm happy about that.
Yeah.
Which that was the... For our listeners out there, we had on our local state-only elections back in August... We had an amendment that said, hey, tax subsidies for people and tax breaks for people who get solar and their renewable energy, specifically solar. So this means it's a hell of a lot easier to get solar.
Yeah,
which I really want to put solar panels up in my house. I really do.
Yeah, I'm there. I'm there with you, man.